Things Fall Apart, Disc 2.
Chapter 5. The feast of the new yam was approaching, and Umwolfia was in a festival mood. It was an occasion for giving thanks to Ani, the earth goddess, and the source of all fertility. Ani played a greater part in the life of the people than any other deity. She was the ultimate judge of morality and conduct, and what was more, she was in close communion with the departed fathers of the clan, whose bodies had been committed to earth. The Feast of the New Yam was held every year before the harvest began, to honor the earth goddess and the ancestral spirits of the clan. New yams could not be eaten until some had first been offered to these powers. Men and women, young and old, looked forward to the new yam festival because it began the season of plenty, the new year. On the last night before the festival, yams of the old year were all disposed of by those who still had them. The new year must begin with tasty, fresh yams and not the shriveled and fibrous crop of the previous year. All cooking pots, calabashes, and wooden bowls were thoroughly washed, especially the wooden mortar in which yam was pounded. Yam fufu and vegetable soup was the chief food in the celebration. So much of it was cooked that no matter how heavily the family ate, or how many friends and relatives they invited from neighboring villages, there was always a large quantity of food left over at the end of the day. The story was always told of a wealthy man who set before his guests a mound of fufu so high that those who sat on one side could not see what was happening on the other, and it was not until late in the evening that one of them saw, for the first time, his in-law, who had arrived during the course of the meal and had fallen to on the opposite side. It was only then that they exchanged greetings and shook hands over what was left of the food. The new yam festival was thus an occasion for joy throughout Umwolfia, and every man whose arm was strong, as the Igbo people say, was expected to invite large numbers of guests from far and wide. Okonkwo always asked his wives' relations, and since he now had three wives, his guests would make a fairly big crowd. But somehow, Okonkwo could never become as enthusiastic over feasts as most people. He was a good eater, and he could drink one or two fairly big gourds of palm wine. But he was always uncomfortable sitting around for days, waiting for a feast or getting over it. He would be very much happier working on his farm. The festival was now only 3 days away. Okonkwo's wives had scrubbed the walls and the huts with red earth until they reflected light. They had then drawn patterns on them in white, yellow, and dark green. They then set about painting themselves with cam wood and drawing beautiful black patterns on their stomachs and on their backs. The children were also decorated, especially their hair, which was shaved in beautiful patterns. The three women talked excitedly about their relations who had been invited, and the children reveled in the thought of being spoiled by these visitors from the motherland. Ikemefuna was equally excited. The new yam festival seemed to him to be a much bigger event here than in his own village, a place which was already becoming remote and vague in his imagination. And then the storm burst. Okonkwo, who had been walking about aimlessly in his compound in suppressed anger, suddenly found an outlet. "Who killed this banana tree?" he asked. A hush fell on the compound immediately. "Who killed this tree? Or are you all deaf and dumb?" As a matter of fact, the tree was very much alive. Okonkwo's second wife had merely cut a few leaves off it to wrap some food, and she said so. Without further argument, Okonkwo gave her a sound beating and left her and her only daughter weeping. Neither of the other wives dared to interfere beyond an occasional and tentative, "It is enough, Okonkwo," pleaded from a reasonable distance. His anger thus satisfied, Okonkwo decided to go out hunting. He had an old rusty gun made by a clever blacksmith who had come to live in Mwofia long ago. But although Okonkwo was a great man whose prowess was universally acknowledged, he was not a hunter. In fact, he had not killed a rat with his gun. And so, when he called Igeme Funa to fetch his gun, the wife who had just been beaten murmured something about guns that never shot. Unfortunately for her, Okonkwo heard it and ran madly into his room for the loaded gun, ran out again, and aimed at her as she clambered over the dwarf wall of the barn. He pressed the trigger, and there was a loud report, accompanied by the wail of his wives and children. He threw down the gun and jumped into the barn, and there lay the woman, very much shaken and frightened, but quite unhurt. He heaved a heavy sigh and went away with the gun. In spite of this incident, the new yam festival was celebrated with great joy in Okonkwo's household. Early that morning, as he offered a sacrifice of new yam and palm oil to his ancestors, he asked them to protect him, his children, and their mothers in the new year. As the day wore on, his in-laws arrived from three surrounding villages, and each party brought with them a huge pot of palm wine. And there was eating and drinking till night, when Okonkwo's in-laws began to leave for their homes. The second day of the new year was the day of the great wrestling match between Okonkwo's village and their neighbors. It was difficult to say which the people enjoyed more, the feasting and fellowship of the first day or the wrestling contest of the second. But there was one woman who had no doubt whatever in her mind. She was Okonkwo's second wife, Ekwefi, whom he nearly shot. There was no festival in all the seasons of the year which gave her as much pleasure as the wrestling match. Many years ago, when she was the village beauty, Okonkwo had won her heart by throwing the cat in the greatest contest within living memory. She did not marry him then because he was too poor to pay her bride price. But a few years later, she ran away from her husband and came to live with Okonkwo. All this happened many years ago. Now, Ekwefi was a woman of 45 who had suffered a great deal in her time. But her love of wrestling contests was still as strong as it was 30 years ago. It was not yet noon, on the second day of the new yam festival. Ekwefi and her only daughter, Ezinma, sat near the fireplace waiting for the water in the pot to boil. The fowl Ekwefi had just killed was in the wooden mortar. The water began to boil, and in one deft movement, she lifted the pot from the fire and poured the boiling water over the fowl. She put back the empty pot on the circular pad in the corner and looked at her palms, which were black with soot. Ezinma was always surprised that her mother could lift a pot from the fire with her bare hands. Ekwefi, she said, is it true that when people are grown up, fire does not burn them? Ezinma, unlike most children, called her mother by her name. Yes, replied Ekwefi, too busy to argue. Her daughter was only 10 years old, but she was wiser than her years. But Nwoye's mother dropped her pot of hot soup the other day, and it broke on the floor. Ekwefi turned the hen over in the mortar and began to pluck the feathers. Ekwefi, said Ezinma, who had joined in plucking the feathers, my eyelid is twitching. It means you are going to cry, said her mother. No, Ezinma said. It is this eyelid, the top one. That means you will see something, What will I see? She asked. How can I know? Ikwefi wanted her to work it out herself.
Oh-ho! Said Azinma at last. I know what it is, the wrestling match.
At last the hen was plucked clean. Ikwefi tried to pull out the horny beak, but it was too hard. She turned round on her low stool and put the beak in the fire for a few moments. She pulled again, and it came off.
Ikwefi!
A voice called from one of the other huts. It was Nwoye's mother, Okonkwo's first wife.
Is that me?
Ikwefi called back. That was the way people answered calls from outside. They never answered yes, for fear it might be an evil spirit calling.
Will you give Azinma some fire to bring to me?
Her own children and Ikemefuna had gone to the stream. Ikwefi put a few live coals into a piece of broken pot, and Azinma carried it across the clean-swept compound to Noye's mother. Thank you, Inma, she said. She was peeling new yams, and in a basket beside her were green vegetables and beans.
Let me make the fire for you, Azinma offered.
Thank you, Ezigbo, she said. She often called her Ezigbo, which means the good one. Azinma went outside and brought some sticks from a huge bundle of firewood. She broke them into little pieces across the sole of her foot and began to build a fire, blowing it with her breath.
You will blow your eyes out,
said Nwoye's mother, looking up from the yams she was peeling.
Use the fan.
She stood up and pulled out the fan, which was fastened into one of the rafters. As soon as she got up, the troublesome nanny goat, which had been dutifully eating yam peelings, dug her teeth into the real thing, scooped out two mouthfuls, and fled from the hut to chew the cud in the goat's shed. Noye's mother swore at her and settled down again to her peeling. Azinma's fire was now sending up thick clouds of smoke. She went on fanning it until it burst into flames. Noye's mother thanked her, and she went back to her mother's hut. Just then, the distant beating of drums began to reach them. It came from the direction of the Ilo, the village playground. Every village had its own Ilo, which was as old as the village itself, and where all the great ceremonies and dances took place. The drums beat the unmistakable wrestling dance, quick, light and gay, and it came floating on the wind. Okonkwo cleared his throat and moved his feet to the beat of the drums. It filled him with fire, as it had always done from his youth. He trembled with the desire to conquer and subdue. It was like the desire for woman.
We should be late for the wrestling, said Azinma to her mother.
They will not begin until the sun goes down.
But they are beating the drums.
Yes, the drums begin at noon, but the wrestling waits until the sun begins to sink. Go and see if your father has brought out yams for the afternoon.
He has. Nwoye's mother is already cooking.
Go and bring our own, then. We must cook quickly, or we shall be late for the wrestling.
Azinma ran in the direction of the barn and brought back two yams from the dwarf wall. Ikwefi peeled the yams quickly. The troublesome nanny goat sniffed about, eating the peelings. She cut the yams into small pieces and began to prepare a pottage using some of the chicken. At that moment, they heard someone crying just outside their compound. It was very much like Obiageli, Nwoye's sister.
Is that not Obiageli weeping?
Ikwefi called across the yard to Nwoye's mother.
Yes, she replied. She must have broken her water pot.
The weeping was now quite close, and soon the children filed in,
carrying on their heads various sizes of pots suitable to their years. Ikemefuna came first with the biggest pot, closely followed by Nwoye and his two younger brothers. Obiageli brought up the rear, her face streaming with tears. In her hand was the cloth pad on which the pot should have rested on her head. "What happened?" her mother asked, and Obiageli told her mournful story. Her mother consoled her and promised to buy her another pot. Nwoye's younger brothers were about to tell their mother the true story of the accident when Ikemefuna looked at them sternly, and they held their peace. The fact was that Obiageli had been making inyanga with her pot. She had balanced it on her head, folded her arms in front of her, and began to sway her waist like a grown-up young lady. When the pot fell down and broke, she burst out laughing. She only began to weep when they got near the Yoroko tree outside their compound. The drums were still beating, persistent and unchanging. Their sound was no longer a separate thing from the living village. It was like the pulsation of its heart. It throbbed in the air, in the sunshine, and even in the trees, and filled the village with excitement. Ekwefi ladled her husband's share of the pottage into a bowl and covered it. Azinma took it to him in his obi. Okonkwo was sitting on a goatskin, already eating his first wife's meal. Obiageli, who had brought it from her mother's hut, sat on the floor waiting for him to finish. Azinma placed her mother's dish before him and sat with Obiageli.
"Sit like a woman,"
Okonkwo shouted at her. Azinma brought her two legs together and stretched them in front of her.
"Father, will you go to see the wrestling?"
Azinma asked after a suitable interval.
"Yes," he answered. "Will you go?"
"Yes."
And after a pause, she said,
"Can I bring your chair for you?"
"No, that is a boy's job."
Okonkwo was specially fond of Azinma. She looked very much like her mother, who was once the village beauty. But his fondness only showed on very rare occasions.
"Obiageli broke her pot today," Azinma said.
"Yes, she has told me about it," Okonkwo said, between mouthfuls.
"Father," said Obiageli, "people should not talk when they are eating, or pepper may go down the wrong way."
"That is very true. Do you hear that, Azinma? You are older than Obiageli, but she has more sense."
He uncovered his second wife's dish and began to eat from it. Obiageli took the first dish and returned to her mother's hut. And then Nkechi came in, bringing the third dish. Nkechi was the daughter of Okonkwo's third wife. In the distance, the drums continued to beat.
Chapter 6. The whole village turned out on the Ilo, men, women, and children. They stood round in a huge circle, leaving the center of the playground free. The elders and grandees of the village sat on their own stools, brought there by their young sons or slaves. Okonkwo was among them. All others stood, except those who came early enough to secure places on the few stands which had been built by placing smooth logs on forked pillars. The wrestlers were not there yet, and the drummers held the field. They too sat just in front of the huge circle of spectators, facing the elders. Behind them was the big and ancient silk cotton tree, which was sacred. Spirits of good children lived in that tree, waiting to be born. On ordinary days, young women who desired children came to sit under its shade. There were seven drums, and they were arranged according to their sizes in a long wooden basket. Three men beat them with sticks, working feverishly from one drum to another. They were possessed by the spirit of the drums. The young men who kept order on these occasions dashed about, consulting among themselves and with the leaders of the two wrestling teams, who were still outside the circle, behind the crowd. Once in a while, two young men carrying palm fronds ran round the circle and kept the crowd back by beating the ground in front of them, or, if they were stubborn, their legs and feet. At last, the two teams danced into the circle, and the crowd roared and clapped. The drums rose to a frenzy. The people surged forward. The young men who kept order flew around, waving their palm fronds. Old men nodded to the beat of the drums and remembered the days when they wrestled to its intoxicating rhythm. The contest began with boys of 15 or 16. There were only three such boys in each team. They were not the real wrestlers. They merely set the scene. Within a short time, the first two bouts were over. But the third created a big sensation, even among the elders who did not usually show their excitement so openly. It was as quick as the other two, perhaps even quicker. But very few people had ever seen that kind of wrestling before. As soon as the two boys closed in, one of them did something which no one could describe because it had been as quick as a flash. And the other boy was flat on his back. The crowd roared and clapped and for a while drowned the frenzied drums. Okonkwo sprang to his feet and quickly sat down again. Three young men from the victorious boy's team ran forward, carried him shoulder high, and danced through the cheering crowd. Everybody soon knew who the boy was. His name was Maduka, the son of Obierika. The drummers stopped for a brief rest before the real matches. Their bodies shone with sweat, and they took up fans and began to fan themselves. They also drank water from small pots and ate kola nuts. They became ordinary human beings again, talking and laughing among themselves and with others who stood near them. The air, which had been stretched taut with excitement, relaxed again. It was as if water had been poured on the tightened skin of a drum. Many people looked around, perhaps for the first time, and saw those who stood or sat next to them. "I did not know it was you," Ekwefi said to the woman who had stood shoulder to shoulder with her since the beginning of the matches. "I do not blame you," said the woman. "I've never seen such a large crowd of people. Is it true that Okonkwo nearly killed you with his gun?" "It is true indeed, my dear friend. I cannot yet find a mouth with which to tell the story." "Your chi is very much awake, my friend. And how is my daughter, Azinma?" "She has been very well for some time now. Perhaps she has come to stay." "I think she has. How old is she now?" "She is about 10 years old." "I think she will stay. They usually stay, if they do not die before the age of 6. "I pray she stays," said Ekwefi, with a heavy sigh. The woman with whom she talked was called Chielo. She was the priestess of Agbala, the oracle of the hills and the caves. In ordinary life, Chielo was a widow with two children. She was very friendly with the Kwefi, and they shared a common shed in the market. She was particularly fond of a Kwefi's only daughter, Azinma, whom she called my daughter. Quite often she brought bean cakes and gave Ekwefi some to take home to Azinma. Anyone seeing Chielo in ordinary life would hardly believe she was the same person who prophesied when the spirit of Agbala was upon her. The drummers took up their sticks, and the air shivered and grew tense like a tightened bow. The two teams were ranged facing each other across the clear space. A young man from one team danced across the center to the other side and pointed at whomever he wanted to fight. They danced back to the center together and then closed in. There were 12 men on each side, and the challenge went from one side to the other. Two judges walked around the wrestlers, and when they thought they were equally matched, stopped them. 5 matches ended in this way, but the really exciting moments were when a man was thrown. The huge voice of the crowd then rose to the sky and in every direction. It was even heard in the surrounding villages. The last match was between the leaders of the teams. They were among the best wrestlers in all the 9 villages. The crowd wondered who would throw the other this year. Some said Okafo was the better man. Others said he was not the equal of Ikezwe. Last year, neither of them had thrown the other, even though the judges had allowed the contest to go on longer than was the custom. They had the same style, and one saw the other's plans beforehand. It might happen again this year. Dusk was already approaching when their contest began. The drums went mad, and the crowds also. They surged forward as the two young men danced into the circle. The palm fronds were helpless in keeping them back. Ikezwe held out his right hand. Okafo seized it, and they closed in. It was a fierce contest. Ikezwe strove to dig in his right heel behind Okafo so as to pitch him backwards in the clever Ege style. But the one knew what the other was thinking. The crowd had surrounded and swallowed up the drummers, whose frantic rhythm was no longer a mere disembodied sound, but the very heartbeat of the people. The wrestlers were now almost still in each other's grip. The muscles on their arms and their thighs and on their backs stood out and twitched. It looked like an equal match. The two judges were already moving forward to separate them, when Ikezwe, now desperate, went down quickly on one knee in an attempt to fling his man backwards over his head. It was a sad miscalculation. Quick as the lightning of a mandiora, Okafo raised his right leg and swung it over his rival's head. The crowd burst into a thunderous roar. Okafo was swept off his feet by his supporters and carried home shoulder high. They sang his praise, and the young women clapped their hands. Who will wrestle for our village? Okafo will wrestle for our village. Has he thrown 100 men? He has thrown 400 men. Has he thrown 100 cats? He has thrown 400 cats. Then send him word to fight for us. Chapter 7. For 3 years, Ikemefuna lived in Okonkwo's household, and the elders of Mwofia seemed to have forgotten about him. He grew rapidly, like a yam tendril in the rainy season, and was full of the sap of life. He had become wholly absorbed into his new family. He was like an elder brother to Nwoye, and from the very first seemed to have kindled a new fire in the younger boy. He made him feel grown up, and they no longer spent the evenings in mother's hut while she cooked, but now sat with Okonkwo in his obi, or watched him as he tapped his palm tree for the evening wine. Nothing pleased Nwoye now more than to be sent for by his mother or another of his father's wives to do one of those difficult and masculine tasks in the home, like splitting wood or pounding food. On receiving such a message through a younger brother or sister, Nwoye would feign annoyance and grumble aloud about women and their troubles. Okonkwo was inwardly pleased at his son's development, and he knew it was due to Ikemefuna. He wanted Nwoye to grow into a tough young man, capable of ruling his father's household when he was dead and gone to join the ancestors. He wanted him to be a prosperous man, having enough in his barn to feed the ancestors with regular sacrifices. And so he was always happy when he heard him grumbling about women. That showed that in time, he would be able to control his womenfolk. No matter how prosperous a man was, if he was unable to rule his women and his children, and especially his women, he was not really a man. He was like the man in the song who had 10 and 1 wives and not enough soup for his fufu. So Okonkwo encouraged the boys to sit with him in his obi, and he told them stories of the land, masculine stories of violence and bloodshed. Nwoye knew that it was right to be masculine and to be violent, but somehow he still preferred the stories that his mother used to tell, and which she no doubt still told to her younger children, stories of the tortoise and his wily ways, and of the bird, Eneke Ntioba, who challenged the whole world to a wrestling contest and was finally thrown by the cat. He remembered the story she often told of the quarrel between earth and sky long ago, and how sky withheld rain for 7 years until crops withered and the dead could not be buried because the hose broke on the stony earth. At last, Vulture was sent to plead with Sky and to soften his heart with a song of the suffering of the sons of men. Whenever Nwoye's mother sang this song, he felt carried away to the distant scene in the sky where Vulture, Earth's emissary, sang for mercy. At last, Sky was moved to pity, and he gave to Vulture rain wrapped in leaves of cocoyam. But as he flew home, his long talon pierced the leaves, and the rain fell as it had never fallen before. And so heavily did it rain on Vulture that he did not return to deliver his message, but flew to a distant land, from where he had espied a fire. And when he got there, he found it was a man making a sacrifice. He warmed himself in the fire and ate the entrails. That was the kind of story that Nwoye loved. But he now knew that they were foolish women and children, and he knew that his father wanted him to be a man. And so he feigned that he no longer cared for women's stories. And when he did this, he saw that his father was pleased and no longer rebuked him or beat him. So Nwoye and Ikemefuna would listen to Okonkwo's stories about tribal wars, or how years ago he had stalked his victim, overpowered him, and obtained his first human head. And as he told them of the past, they sat in darkness or the dim glow of logs, waiting for the women to finish their cooking. When they finished, each brought her bowl of fufu and bowl of soup to her husband. An oil lamp was lit, and Okonkwo tasted from each bowl, and then passed 2 shares to Nwoye and Ikemefuna. In this way, the moons and the seasons passed, and then the locusts came. It had not happened for many a long year. The elders said locusts came once in a generation, reappeared every year for 7 years, and then disappeared for another lifetime. They went back to their caves in a distant land, where they were guarded by a race of stunted men. And then, after another lifetime, these men opened the caves again, and the locusts came to Umofia. They came in the cold Harmattan season, after the harvests had been gathered, and ate up all the wild grass in the fields. Okonkwo and the 2 boys were working on the red outer walls of the compound. This was one of the lighter tasks of the after-harvest season. A new cover of thick palm branches and palm leaves was set on the walls to protect them from the next rainy season. Okonkwo worked on the outside of the wall, and the boys worked from within. There were little holes from one side to the other in the upper levels of the wall, and through these Okonkwo passed the rope, or tie-tie, to the boys, and they passed it round the wooden stays and then back to him. And in this way the cover was strengthened on the wall. The women had gone to the bush to collect firewood, and the little children to visit their playmates in the neighboring compounds. The harmattan was in the air, and seemed to distill a hazy feeling of sleep on the world. Okonkwo and the boys worked in complete silence, which was only broken when a new palm frond was lifted onto the wall, or when a busy hen moved dry leaves about in her ceaseless search for food. And then, quite suddenly, a shadow fell on the world, and the sun seemed hidden behind a thick cloud. Okonkwo looked up from his work and wondered if it was going to rain at such an unlikely time of the year. But almost immediately, a shout of joy broke out in all directions, and Umofia, which had dozed in the noonday haze, broke into life and activity. "Locusts are descending!" was joyfully chanted everywhere, and men, women, and children left their work or their play and ran into the open to see the unfamiliar sight. The locusts had not come for many, many years, and only the old people had seen them before. At first, a fairly small swarm came. They were the harbingers sent to survey the land. And then appeared on the horizon a slow-moving mass like a boundless sheet of black cloud drifting towards Umofia. Soon it covered half the sky, and the solid mass was now broken by tiny eyes of light-like shining stardust. It was a tremendous sight, full of power and beauty. Everyone was now about, talking excitedly, and praying that the locusts should camp in Umofia for the night. For although locusts had not visited Umofia for many years, everybody knew by instinct that they were very good to eat. And at last, the locusts did descend. They settled on every tree and on every blade of grass. They settled on the roofs and covered the bare ground. Mighty tree branches broke away under them, and the whole country became the brown earth color of the vast, hungry swarm. Many people went out with baskets, trying to catch them, but the elders counseled patience till nightfall. And they were right. The locusts settled in the bushes for the night, and their wings became wet with dew. Then all Umofia turned out in spite of the cold harmattan, and everyone filled his bags and pots with locusts. The next morning they were roasted in clay pots and then spread in the sun until they became dry and brittle. And for many days this rare food was eaten with solid palm oil. Okonkwo sat in his obi, crunching happily with Ikemefuna and Woye, and drinking palm wine copiously, when Ogwefi Ezeudu came in. Ezeudu was the oldest man in this quarter of Umofia. He had been a great and fearless warrior in his time, and was now accorded great respect in all the clan. He refused to join in the meal, and asked Okonkwo to have a word with him outside. And so they walked out together, the old man supporting himself with his stick. When they were out of earshot, he said to Okonkwo, "That boy calls you father. Do not bear a hand in his death." Okonkwo was surprised, and was about to say something when the old man continued, "Yes, Umofia has decided to kill him. The oracle of the hills and the caves has pronounced it. They will take him outside Umofia, as is the custom, and kill him there. But I want you to have nothing to do with it.
He calls you his father.
The next day, a group of elders from all the 9 villages of Umofia came to Okonkwo's house early in the morning. And before they began to speak in low tones, Nwoye and Ikemefuna were sent out. They did not stay very long, but when they went away, Okonkwo sat still for a very long time, supporting his chin in his palms. Later in the day, he called Ikemefuna and told him that he was to be taken home the next day. Nwoye overheard it and burst into tears, whereupon his father beat him heavily. As for Ikemefuna, he was at a loss. His own home had gradually become very faint and distant. He still missed his mother and his sister, and would be very glad to see them, but somehow, he knew he was not going to see them. He remembered once when men had talked in low tones with his father, and it seemed now as if it was happening all over again. Later, Nwoye went to his mother's hut and told her that Ikemefuna was going home. She immediately dropped her pestle, with which she was grinding pepper, folded her arms across her breast, and sighed, "Poor child." The next day, the men returned with a pot of wine. They were all fully dressed, as if they were going to a big clan meeting or to pay a visit to a neighboring village. They passed their cloths under their right armpit and hung their goatskin bags and sheathed machetes over their left shoulders. Okonkwo got ready quickly, and the party set out with Ikemefuna carrying the pot of wine. A deathly silence descended on Okonkwo's compound. Even the very little children seemed to know. Throughout that day, Nwoye sat in his mother's hut, and tears stood in his eyes. At the beginning of their journey, the men of Umofia talked and laughed about the locusts, about their women, and about some effeminate men who had refused to come with them. But as they drew near to the outskirts of Umofia, silence fell upon them too. The sun rose slowly to the center of the sky, and the dry, sandy footway began to throw up the heat that lay buried in it. Some birds chirruped in the forests around. The men trod dry leaves on the sand. All else was silent. Then from the distance came the faint beating of the ekwe. It rose and faded with the wind, a peaceful dance from a distant clan. "It is an Ozo dance," the men said among themselves, but no one was sure where it was coming from. Some said, "Izimili," others, "Abame," or "Aninta." They argued for a short while and fell into silence again, and the elusive dance rose and fell with the wind. Somewhere, a man was taking one of the titles of his clan, with music and dancing and a great feast. The footway had now become a narrow line in the heart of the forest. The short trees and sparse undergrowth which surrounded the men's village began to give way to giant trees and climbers which perhaps had stood from the beginning of things, untouched by the axe and the bushfire. The sun, breaking through their leaves and branches, threw a pattern of light and shade on the sandy footway. Ikemefuna heard a whisper close behind him and turned round sharply. The man who had whispered now called out aloud, urging the others to hurry up. "We still have a long way to go," he said. Then he and another man went before Ikemefuna and set a faster pace. Thus the men of Umofia pursued their way, armed with sheathed machetes, and Ikemefuna, carrying a pot of palm wine on his head, walked in their midst. Although he had felt uneasy at first, he was not afraid now. Okonkwo walked behind him. He could hardly imagine that Okonkwo was not his real father. He had never been fond of his real father, and at the end of 3 years, he had become very distant indeed. But his mother and his 3-year-old sister. Of course, she would not be 3 now, but 6. Would he recognize her now? She must have grown quite big. His mother would weep for joy and thank Okonkwo for having looked after him so well and for bringing him back. She would want to hear everything that had happened to him in all these years. Could he remember them all? He would tell her about Nwoye and his mother and about the locusts. Then quite suddenly, a thought came upon him. His mother might be dead. He tried in vain to force the thought out of his mind. Then he tried to settle the matter the way he used to settle such matters when he was a little boy. He still remembered the song. Eze, Elina, Elina, Sala, Eze, Ilikwa, Ya, Iguaba, Aqua, Olig Holi, Ebe, Tanda, Nechi, Eze, Ebe, Izuzu, Nete, Egu, Sala. He sang it in his mind and walked to its beat. If the song ended on his right foot, his mother was alive. If it ended on his left, she was dead. No, not dead, but ill. It ended on the right. She was alive and well. He sang the song again, and it ended on the left. But the second time did not count. The first voice gets to Chukwu, or God's house. That was a favorite saying of children. Ikemefuna felt like a child once more. It must be the thought of going home to his mother. One of the men behind him cleared his throat. Ikemefuna looked back, and the man growled at him to go on and not stand looking back. The way he said it sent cold fear down Ikemefuna's back. His hands trembled vaguely on the black pot he carried. Why had Okonkwo withdrawn to the rear? Ikemefuna felt his legs melting under him, and he was afraid to look back. As the man who had cleared his throat drew up and raised his machete, Okonkwo looked away. He heard the blow. The pot fell and broke in the sand. He heard Ikemefuna cry, "My father, they have killed me," as he ran towards him. Dazed with fear, Okonkwo drew his machete and cut him down. He was afraid of being thought weak. As soon as his father walked in that night, Nwoye knew that Ikemefuna had been killed, and something seemed to give way inside him, like the snapping of a tightened bow. He did not cry. He just hung limp. He had had the same kind of feeling not long ago, during the last harvest season. Every child loved the harvest season. Those who were big enough to carry even a few yams in a tiny basket went with grown-ups to the farm, and if they could not help in digging up the yams, they could gather firewood together for roasting the ones that would be eaten there on the farm. This roasted yam soaked in red palm oil and eaten in the open farm was sweeter than any meal at home. It was after such a day at the farm, during the last harvest, that Nwoye had felt for the first time a snapping inside him, like the one he now felt. They were returning home with baskets of yams from a distant farm across the stream, when they heard the voice of an infant crying in the thick forest. A sudden hush had fallen on the women who had been talking, and they had quickened their steps. Nwoye had heard that twins were put in earthenware pots and thrown away in the forest, but he had never yet come across them. A vague chill had descended on him, and his head had seemed to swell, like a solitary walker at night who passes an evil spirit on the way. Then something had given way inside him. It descended on him again, this feeling, when his father walked in, that night, after killing Ikemefuna. Chapter 8. Okonkwo did not taste any food for 2 days after the death of Ikemefuna. He drank palm wine from morning till night, and his eyes were red and fierce, like the eyes of a rat when it was caught by the tail and dashed against the floor. He called his son, Nwoye, to sit with him in his obi, but the boy was afraid of him and slipped out of the hut as soon as he noticed him dozing. He did not sleep at night. He tried not to think about Ikemefuna, but the more he tried, the more he thought about him. Once he got up from bed and walked about his compound, but he was so weak that his legs could hardly carry him. He felt like a drunken giant walking with the limbs of a mosquito. Now and then, a cold shiver descended on his head and spread down his body. On the third day, he asked his second wife, Ekwefi, to roast plantains for him. She prepared it the way he liked, with slices of oil bean and fish. "You have not eaten for 2 days," said his daughter, Ezinma, when she brought the food to him. "So you must finish this." She sat down and stretched her legs in front of her. Okonkwo ate the food absent-mindedly. "She should have been a boy," he thought, as he looked at his 10-year-old daughter. He passed her a piece of fish. "Go and bring me some cold water," he said. Ezinma rushed out of the hut, chewing the fish, and soon returned with a bowl of cool water from the earthen pot in her mother's hut. Okonkwo took the bowl from her and gulped the water down. He ate a few more pieces of plantain and pushed the dish aside. "Bring me my bag," he asked. And Ezinma brought his goatskin bag from the far end of the hut. He searched in it for his snuff bottle. It was a deep bag and took almost the whole length of his arm. It contained other things apart from his snuff bottle. There was a drinking horn in it, and also a drinking gourd, and they knocked against each other as he searched. When he brought out the snuff bottle, he tapped it a few times against his kneecap before taking out some snuff on the palm of his left hand. Then he remembered that he had not taken out his snuff spoon. He searched his bag again and brought out a small, flat, ivory spoon, with which he carried the brown snuff to his nostrils. Ezinma took the dish in one hand and the empty water bowl in the other and went back to her mother's hut. "She should have been a boy," Okonkwo said to himself again. His mind went back to Ikemefuna, and he shivered. If only he could find some work to do, he would be able to forget. But it was the season of rest between the harvest and the next planting season. The only work that men did at this time was covering the walls of their compound with new palm fronds. And Okonkwo had already done that. He had finished it on the very day the locusts came, when he had worked on one side of the wall, and Ikemefuna and Nwoye on the other. "When did you become a shivering old woman?" Okonkwo asked himself. "You, who are known in all the 9 villages for your valor in war. How can a man who has killed 5 men in battle fall to pieces because he has added a boy to their number? Okonkwo, you have become a woman indeed." He sprang to his feet, hung his goatskin bag on his shoulder, and went to visit his friend, Obiorika. Obiorika was sitting outside, under the shade of an orange tree, making thatches from leaves of the raffia palm. He exchanged greetings with Okonkwo and led the way into his obi. I was coming over to see you as soon as I finished the thatch, he said, rubbing off the grains of sand that clung to his thighs.
Is it well? Okonkwo asked.
Yes, replied Obiereka. My daughter's suitor is coming today, and I hope we will clinch the matter of the bride price. I want you to be there.
Just then, Obierika's son, Maduka, came into the obi from outside, greeted Okonkwo, and turned towards the compound.
Come and shake hands with me, Okonkwo said to the lad. Your wrestling the other day gave me much happiness. The boy smiled, shook hands with Okonkwo, and went into the compound.
He will do great things, Okonkwo said. If I had a son like him, I should be happy. I am worried about Nwoye. A bowl of pounded yams can throw him in a wrestling match. His two younger brothers are more promising. But I can tell you, Obierika, that my children do not resemble me. Where are the young suckers that will grow when the old banana tree dies? If Azinma had been a boy, I would have been happier. She has the right spirit.
You worry yourself for nothing, said Obierika. The children are still very young.
Nwoye is old enough to impregnate a woman. At his age, I was already fending for myself. No, my friend, he is not too young. A chick that will grow into a cock can be spotted the very day it hatches. I have done my best to make Nwoye grow into a man, but there is too much of his mother in him.
Too much of his grandfather, Obierika thought, but he did not say it. The same thought also came to Okonkwo's mind, but he had long learned how to lay that ghost. Whenever the thought of his father's weakness and failure troubled him, he expelled it by thinking about his own strength and success, and so he did now. His mind went to his latest show of manliness.
I cannot understand why you refuse to come with us to kill that boy, he asked Obierika.
Because I did not want to, Obierika replied sharply. I had something better to do.
You sound as if you question the authority in the decision of the oracle, who said he should die.
I do not. Why should I? But the oracle did not ask me to carry out its decision.
But someone had to do it. If we were all afraid of blood, it would not be done. And what do you think the oracle would do then?
You know very well, Okonkwo, that I am not afraid of blood. And if anyone tells you that I am, he is telling a lie. And let me tell you one thing, my friend. If I were you, I would have stayed at home. What you have done will not please the earth. It is the kind of action for which the goddess wipes out whole families.
The earth cannot punish me for obeying her messenger, Okonkwo said. A child's fingers are not scalded by a piece of hot yam which its mother puts into its palm.
That is true, Obierika agreed. But if the oracle said that my son should be killed, I would neither dispute it nor be the one to do it. They would have gone on arguing, had Ofoedu not come in just then. It was clear from his twinkling eyes that he had important news, but it would be impolite to rush him. Obierika offered him a lobe of the kolonut he had broken with Okonkwo. Ofoedu ate slowly and talked about the locusts. When he finished his kolonut, he said,
"The things that happen these days are very strange."
What has happened? Asked Okonkwo. Do you know Ogbuefi Ondulue? Ofuedu asked.
Ogbuefi Ondulue,
of Ire village, Okonkwo and Obierika said together.
He died this morning, said Ofuedu.
That is not strange. He was the oldest man in Ire, said Obierika.
You are right, Ofuedu agreed. but you ought to ask why the drum has not beaten to tell Umofia of his death.
Why? Asked Obierica and Okonkwo together.
That is the strange part of it.
You know his first wife, who walks with a stick?
Yes.
She is called Ozoemena.
That is so, said Ofoedu.
Ozoemena was, as you know, too old to attend Undulue during his illness. His younger wives did that. When he died this morning, one of these women went to Ozoemena's hut and told her. She rose from her mat, took her stick, and walked over to the Obi. She knelt on her knees and hands at the threshold and called her husband, who was laid on a mat.
Ogbuefi, Ndulue,
she called three times and went back to her hut. When the youngest wife went to call her again to be present at the washing of the body, she found her lying on the mat, dead.
That is very strange indeed, said Okonkwo.
They will put off Ndulue's funeral until his wife has been buried.
That is why the drum has not been beaten to tell Umofia.
It was always said that Ndulue and Ozoemena had one mind, said Obierica. I remember when I was a young boy, there was a song about them. He could not do anything without telling her.
I did not know that, said Okonkwo. I thought he was a strong man in his youth.
He was indeed, said Ofoedu.
Okonkwo shook his head doubtfully.
He led Umofia to war in those days, said Obierica.
Okonkwo was beginning to feel like his old self again. All that he required was something to occupy his mind. If he had killed Ikemefuna during the busy planting season, or harvesting, it would not have been so bad. His mind would have been centered on his work. Okonkwo was not a man of thought, but of action. But in absence of work, talking was the next best. Soon after Ofoedu left, Okonkwo took up his goatskin bag to go.
I must go home to tap my palm trees for the afternoon, he said.
Who taps your tall trees for you? Asked Obierica.
Umezulike, replied Okonkwo.
Sometimes I wish I had not taken the Ozo title, said Obierica. It wounds my heart to see these young men killing palm trees in the name of tapping.
It is so indeed, Okonkwo agreed. But the law of the land must be obeyed.
I don't know how we got that law, said Obierica. In many other clans, a man of title is not forbidden to climb the palm tree. Here we say he cannot climb the tall tree, but he can tap the short one standing on the ground.
It is like Dimaragana, who would not lend his knife for cutting up dog meat because the dog was taboo to him, but offered to use his teeth.
I think it is good that our clan holds the Ozo title in high esteem, said Okonkwo. In those other clans you speak of, Ozo is so low that every beggar takes it.
I was only speaking in jest, said Obierica. In Abame and Aninta, the title is worth less than 2 cowries. Every man wears the thread of title on his ankle and does not lose it even if he steals.
They have indeed soiled the name of Ozo, said Okonkwo as he rose to go.
It will not be very long now before my in-laws come, said Obierica.
I shall return very soon, said Okonkwo, looking at the position of the sun.
There were 7 men in Obierica's hut when Okonkwo returned. The suitor was a young man of about 25, and with him were his father and uncle. On Obierica's side were his 2 elder brothers, and Moduka, his 16-year-old son.
Ask Akweke's mother to send us some kola nuts, said Obierica to his son.
Madhuka vanished into the compound like lightning. The conversation at once centered on him, and everybody agreed that he was as sharp as a razor.
I sometimes think he is too sharp, said Obiereka, somewhat indulgently. He hardly ever walks. He is always in a hurry. If you are sending him on an errand, he flies away before he has heard half of the message.
You were very much like that yourself, said his eldest brother. As our people say, when mother cow is chewing grass, its young ones watch its mouth. Madhuka has been watching your mouth.
As he was speaking, the boy returned, followed by Akweke, his half-sister, carrying a wooden dish with 3 kola nuts and alligator pepper. She gave the dish to her father's eldest brother and then shook hands very shyly with her suitor and his relatives. She was about 16 and just ripe for marriage. Her suitor and his relatives surveyed her young body with expert eyes as if to assure themselves that she was beautiful and ripe. She wore a coiffure which was done up into a crest in the middle of the head. Camwood was rubbed lightly into her skin, and all over her body were black patterns drawn with uli. She wore a black necklace, which hung down in 3 coils just above her full, succulent breasts. On her arms were red and yellow bangles, and on her waist, 4 or 5 rows of jigida, or waist beads. When she had shaken hands, or rather, held out her hand to be shaken, she returned to her mother's hut to help with the cooking. Remove your jigida first, her mother warned, as she moved near the fireplace to bring the pestle resting against the wall. Every day I tell you that jigida and fire are not friends, but you will never hear. You grew your ears for decoration, not for hearing. One of these days, your jigida will catch fire on your waist, and then you will know. Akweke moved to the other end of the hut and began to remove the waist beads. It had to be done slowly and carefully, taking each string separately. Else it would break, and the 1,000 tiny rings would have to be strung together again. She rubbed each string downwards with her palms until it passed the buttocks and slipped down to the floor around her feet. The men in the obi had already begun to drink the palm wine which Akweke's suitor had brought. It was a very good wine and powerful, for in spite of the palm fruit hung across the mouth of the pot to restrain the lively liquor, white foam rose and spilled over. That wine is the work of a good tapper, said Okonkwo. The young suitor, whose name was Ibe, smiled broadly and said to his father, Do you hear that? He then said to the others, He will never admit that I am a good tapper. He tapped 3 of my best palm trees to death, said his father, Ukegbu. That was about 5 years ago, said Ibe, who had begun to pour out the wine, before I learned how to tap. He filled the first horn and gave to his father. Then he poured out for the others. Okonkwo brought out his big horn from the goatskin bag, blew into it to remove any dust that might be there, and gave it to Ibe to fill. As the men drank, they talked about everything except the thing for which they had gathered. It was only after the pot had been emptied that the suitor's father cleared his voice and announced the object of their visit. Obiereka then presented to him a small bundle of short broomsticks. Ukegbu counted them. They are 30? He asked. Obiereka nodded in agreement.
We are at last getting somewhere, Ukegbu said, and then turning to his brother and his son, he said, Let us go out and whisper together.
The 3 rose and went outside. When they returned, Ukegbu handed the bundle of sticks to Obiereka. He counted them. Instead of 30, there were now only 15. He passed them over to his eldest brother, Machi, who also counted them and said, "We had not thought to go below 30, but as the dog said, if I fall down for you and you fall down for me, it is play. Marriage should be a play and not a fight. So we are falling down again." He then added 10 sticks to the 15 and gave the bundle to Okegbu. In this way, Akweke's bride price was finally settled at 20 bags of cowries. It was already dusk when the two parties came to this agreement. "Go and tell Akweke's mother that we have finished," Obiereka said to his son, Maduka. Almost immediately, the women came in with a big bowl of fufu. Obiereka's second wife followed with a pot of soup, and Maduka brought in a pot of palm wine. As the men ate and drank palm wine, they talked about the customs of their neighbors. "It was only this morning," said Obiereka, "that Okonkwo and I were talking about Abame and Aninta, where titled men climb trees and pound fufu for their wives. All their customs are upside down. They do not decide bride price as we do, with sticks. They haggle and bargain as if they were buying a goat or a cow in the market." "That is very bad," said Obiereka's eldest brother. "But what is good in one place is bad in another place. In Umunso, they do not bargain at all, not even with broomsticks. The suitor just goes on bringing bags of cowries until his in-laws tell him to stop. It is a bad custom, because it always leads to a quarrel." "The world is large," said Okonkwo. "I've even heard that in some tribes, a man's children belong to his wife and her family." "That cannot be," said Machi. "You might as well say that the woman lies on top of the man when they are making the children." "It is like the story of white men who, they say, are white like this piece of chalk," said Obiereka. He held up a piece of chalk, which every man kept in his obi, and with which his guests drew lines on the floor before they ate kola nuts. "And these white men, they say, have no toes." "And have you never seen them?" asked Machi.
"Have you?"
asked Obiereka.
"One of them passes here frequently," said Machi. "His name is Amadi."
Those who knew Amadi laughed. He was a leper, and the polite name for leprosy was the white skin.
This ends Disc 2.